This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
BP gives us its take on who's to blame for the oil spill.
Any guesses how much blame BP will take for itself?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media, hello, I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York, in for Bill Radke today. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Wednesday, September 8th.
Coming up, seems like every week we hear about another industry that's fallen prey to the internet. Is the internet good or bad for the economy overall?
But first, the British oil giant BP just released an internal report that says multiple companies and people are to blame for the Gulf of Mexico oil leak. The report says a series of complex failures led to the Deepwater Horizon oil rig explosion. Marketplace's London Bureau Chief Stephen Beard has been looking over the report and joins us from London. Good morning, Stephen.
Hello, Jeremy.
Well, Stephen, it's an internal report, so not surprisingly, BP is not taking too much of the blame. But does it exonerate BP?
No, not entirely. As you say, BP tries to spread the blame. It says a whole series of failures caused the spill, failures by BP and its partners in the Gulf. BP admits some of its staff misread pressure gauges on the rig, but it also takes Halliburton to task for the quality of its cement work on the well, and it repeatedly points the finger at the rig owner Transocean, particularly for the failure of the blowout preventer, which didn't stop the flow of oil. Geoffrey Maitland is Professor of Energy Engineering at Imperial College in London. He told the BBC that BP's report looks a little one-sided.
My initial impression is that it's chosen to be selective about the things that look as though they could be the responsibility of other companies without recognising what their own involvement in those decisions was.
And Stephen, I just want to ask you, not long ago we were talking about BP potentially going bankrupt as a result of this oil spill. Has the outlook for the company changed?
Yes, it's definitely improved. I mean, the stock market certainly this morning liked BP's report. The shares were at one point up more than 2%. And Fitch, the credit rating agency, has just raised BP's credit rating. So BP is certainly not the basket case it appeared a few months ago.
What a difference a few months makes. Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thanks.
Okay, Jeremy.
So BP takes partial responsibility. Let's get some reaction from an analyst this morning. Barbara Shook is Houston Bureau Chief and Reporter at Large for the Energy Intelligence Group. She's with us from Houston. Good morning, Barbara.
Good morning, Steve.
BP paints this thing, Barbara, with a pretty big brush. I mean, what does it mean for its relationship with these other companies that they implicate in this report?
BP is going to have to work with these companies in the future, and so at this point, I think they're trying to minimize their legal liability to the maximum degree possible while knowing that it's still going to have to work with these companies. But right now, the big concern is minimizing that legal liability for the lawsuits that are going to go on for probably the next two decades.
Well, minimizing. So I'm curious, with all the litigation, as you mentioned, in the disaster, could BP really admit much more than it has?
Absolutely not. The lawsuits are going to make past litigation in the oil patch, such as the Texaco Pennzoil actions, look like penny ante card games.
Texaco, explain that a little bit.
That had to do with who lured whom into what kind of a mergered transaction, and the original damage awards exceeded $10 billion, if I recall correctly. That was about 15 years ago. I think the total numbers in this event could be even larger when you throw in the environmental penalties.
Hey, quickly, Barbara, could this be, I don't know, like a PR move to preempt other reports about what happened, sort of BP's way of controlling the message?
Very, very certainly. we've had numerous hearings here in Houston and throughout the Gulf Coast area. Halliburton has made its case in those hearings, and its case is, believe me, diametrically opposite to what came out in the BP report today.
Barbara Shook,
we already have other arguments.
Barbara Shook from the Energy Intelligence Report. Thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Always a pleasure to be on.
Even more woes for the fossil fuel sector, this time coming from the White House. To pay for some of President Obama's economic ideas, like fixing infrastructure, he's trying to eliminate some tax breaks, specifically some deductions that oil and gas companies currently enjoy. From the Sustainability Desk in Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
A big chunk of the $50 billion the president wants to pay for new infrastructure would come from cutting tax breaks for drilling. One of those deductions lets oil and gas companies offset taxes they pay overseas. Another goes to firms producing oil and gas domestically. Analyst Kevin Book at Clearview Energy Research says the environment's bad for oil firms. In the spring, they'd banked on a climate bill with give and take. Now, the bill's history. And with the BP fallout, it's all about giving till it hurts.
For energy companies, the clamps are on. Regulation is still pervasive and increasing, and now Congress has a funding gap and no reason to tie their hands behind their back when it comes to changing tax policy for fossil fuels.
Even if the president's ideas fall flat, oil and gas subsidies are a frequently targeted ATM for other ideas, like tax breaks for renewable energy. Petroleum industry groups say the changes would make American production less competitive and increase imports of foreign energy. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong, The Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, September 8th. I'm Steve Chiotakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at our website, marketplace.org. We're going to get a take now on the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects us here in the United States. The European Union continues to divide over plans to tax the banks there. The big bank tax is supposed to curb financial risk-taking and help prevent a future financial crisis. But as the BBC's Tim Bowler reports from London, as with many European debates, this one has a number of different perspectives.
The big stumbling block is taxing bank transactions. Tax supporters say that would help curb excessive risk-taking by adding some extra costs for short-term betting. However, opponents say banks would easily be able to avoid this by shifting deal-making to other countries, particularly the United States, which has not introduced such a tax. Dominic Barbe is from BNP Paribas.
On the caption markets, we've got so much liquidity and possibility of moving activity from one center to another that it will be extremely difficult to tax financial activities.
Despite the dispute over the bank transaction tax, there is mostly agreement over taxing bank profits. And yet, even then, Europe has also failed to agree on where the money from an agreed-upon tax would go. Germany wants the money to fund a rescue account, but Britain and France want the money to go straight back into their national budgets. Despite the disagreements, Europe has in many ways gone further down the line than the US. Congress failed to back a plan to introduce a $19 billion tax on the profits of large banks and hedge funds. In London, I'm the BBC's Tim Bowler reporting for Marketplace.
People in the southern African country of Mozambique are celebrating today after their government reversed a price hike on bread. The increase was in response to how much more the country was having to pay for wheat and grain. It sparked food riots with demonstrations and clashes with police. 13 people died in the violence. Reporter Gretchen Wilson is with us from Johannesburg. Hi, Gretchen.
Hi, Steve.
What's happening right now in Mozambique?
Well, Mozambique's planning minister is saying the government will reverse the 30% price hike on bread. He also says the government will suspend salary increases for top officials. And you might wonder about this. Why is this such a big deal? Why were people burning tires and dodging rubber bullets just over bread? But you really have to understand the local context. Rolls of bread are a staple food for Mozambicans, and the government's price increase jacked the price of one bread roll to 20 U.S. cents. This is in one of the poorest countries in the world. The average full-time worker makes just a little bit more than a dollar a day.
With the reversal, things are quiet. Could things heat back up again?
Certainly. The bigger issue is certainly not resolved. This is an ongoing clash about food security and the ability of poor nations to feed their citizens. Mozambique, for example, grows only about a third of the wheat it needs to make those bread rolls. So this story is not just about Mozambique. It really has its roots in another country more than 5,000 miles away.
Which country is that, and how is that affecting food prices in Mozambique?
Well, you really have to look to Russia. Global prices for wheat skyrocketed after Russia canceled all of its wheat exports. Droughts and fires there really hampered wheat productions. And that's what prompted the price hike on Mozambique's bread rolls. The government now says it's going to subsidize the purchase of wheat to keep bread prices the same. It's also going to maintain the price of other imported foods, things like rice and certain vegetables, by cutting custom duties and taxes.
All right. Reporter Gretchen Wilson from Johannesburg. Gretchen, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, September 8th. I'm Jeremy Hobson in for Bill Radke. For the latest look at the markets, by the way, you can go to the numbers at marketplace.org. As the recession drags on, people are still cutting back on purchases, but that isn't the case when it comes to political spending. Candidates are setting fundraising records this year, and while corporate America is certainly giving its share, it's not doing so in a very straightforward way. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith explains.
Companies are giving more to political campaigns, but they're being quiet about it. Earlier this year, the Supreme Court lifted restrictions on how much money companies could pour into political advertising. But don't expect to see ads knocking your local senator brought to you by Walmart, says Larry Sabato, director of the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia. He says companies don't want to be seen politicking.
The last thing a company wants to do is to alienate shareholders or customers.
Sabato points to the customer backlash Target saw after contributing money to ads supporting a Republican candidate for governor. But the Supreme Court's decision also lifted content and timing restrictions on political ads by trade associations and union groups. Campaign finance lawyer Michael Toner says that has companies donating a lot more money to those groups.
That really opened up the optimal advertising opportunities for trade associations and then social welfare groups.
Toner says we'll see the effect of all that money in the next 8 weeks. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
In the midst of all the government efforts to stimulate home buying, here's a surprise. The cost of mortgage insurance backed by the Federal Housing Administration is set to increase this fall. Marketplace's John Dimsdale explains what that means for home buyers.
Recent foreclosures and delinquencies have depleted the FHA fund that insures mortgages. To restore it, Congress allowed the agency to nearly triple the monthly premiums. FHA Commissioner David Stevens says the price won't go up to the maximum, but the increase will still average nearly $40 a month.
Today, FHA's portfolio has experienced a significant amount of stress because a lot of the loans we originated during the heyday ended up being very high-risk loans.
To help homebuyers afford the hike, FHA is lowering the initial down payment for insurance by close to $1,000 on average. Still, John Anderson with Twin Oaks Realty in Minneapolis says the higher premiums could push some crucial homebuyers out of the market.
So if we have a first-time homebuyer, when it gets right down to it, $10 a month, $20 a month can make a difference in what house they're going to be able to buy. It is going to affect an affordability.
The fee increase, originally set to begin this week, was delayed a month to give lenders more time to update their computer systems. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Prices of e-reader devices such as the Kindle and the Nook have been dropping pretty fast, and that's making the technology accessible to more and more users. And as the e-reader market heats up, we asked Marketplace's sustainability reporter Adrian Hill to find out which is better for the environment, regular paper books or electronic readers.
Let's have an environmental boxing match. In this corner, weighing in at 8.5 ounces, the e-reader. The environmental downsides, e-waste, electricity use, mining products. And in the other corner, the old school favorite, books. There we've got to worry about paper, trees, water, and chemicals.
Touch gloves, go to your corner, and come out fighting!
It's not an easy fight to call. It depends on how many books you read and where you get them. Emma Rich, an analyst with the Clean Tech Group, says the e-reader comes out on top.
Most people aren't going to the library. They're not borrowing books. They're not recycling them when they're done with them.
But James McQuivey of Forrester Research says people don't think that way. The fight just doesn't matter.
People love to say that they care about the environment, but when they make purchases, they generally make purchases based on things that are a little easier for them to measure.
Like cost and convenience. Gina Garcia is a good case in point. She sits in a park reading on her Kindle. It's a toasty day in early September in downtown Los Angeles.
It never occurred to me that this was an environmentally friendly thing to do. It just never crossed my mind.
She didn't like the mess books made in her bedroom. McQuivey from Forrester thinks there's another reason that e-reader sellers won't be touting their environmental friendliness.
The problem with that message is it's one that Amazon and Barnes & Noble don't want to send because they want to continue to sell you physical books because they know you're still going to want some.
McQuivey does think we'll get to the point where e-readers and tablet devices like the iPad are more environmentally friendly and use less energy than they do now. Why? Because none of us wants to have to remember to keep charging the things. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
And if you want to check out more on the environmental rumble between e-readers and paper books, head on over to Adrienne's blog, Easy Answers. It's at our website, marketplace.org.
Seems like just about every day there's another story about how the internet has reshaped this business or that business, how some iPhone app has put some poor mom and pop out of their jobs. Well, just for kicks, we wanted to do the math on whether the internet has been good or bad for the economy overall. So we've invited Porter Bibb into the studio. He spent much of his career in old media at the New York Times and Newsweek, and now he runs the consulting firm MediaTek Capital Partners. Porter Bibb, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here.
The internet, it's ruining old media like newspapers and magazines. It's apparently making office space less important. Headhunters are out of a job. Are there any other things I've left off the list?
You might include landline telephones, which have virtually disappeared from the face of the earth. They are also is a very negative impact that the internet has created on, of all things, flea markets.
Huh.
eBay, on which you can sell anything globally, has replaced antique stores and flea markets around the world. The other big loser probably in the internet is the U.S. Postal Service. Regular mail has dropped precipitously over the last decade in the face of an onslaught of email.
So does this mean the internet is bad for the economy generally?
Essentially, it is a technological innovation on many levels is the best thing that's ever happened to the global economy. It's created an information explosion. It's helped productivity around the world. It's connected the global economy.
Do you think that there are industries that don't know yet what's coming to them that haven't been affected by the rise of the internet but soon will be?
Virtually anybody today in business knows that the internet is going to change the way he does business. And I think that it's really a question of whether they have figured out how to transition to the internet and to digital or not. I'd like to add one other thing that is actually a huge beneficiary of the internet revolution, and that is radio, and particularly public radio and programs like Marketplace, because the podcast on the internet allows anybody, anywhere, anytime to hear this program.
And we paid Porter to say that, by the way. Our Marketplace podcast is available online. Porter Bibb, thanks so much for coming in.
It's always a pleasure.
Porter Bibb is managing director at MediaTek Capital Partners here in New York. And finally, we live in a consumer-driven world, not even able to escape it in the movie theater. Before the movie starts, there are previews for other flicks, of course, but increasingly there are commercials for everything from soda to sneakers to cars.
Well, Jeremy, one Chinese woman had enough. Huh. She is suing a cinema and the distributors of this Chinese box office hit, Aftershock, for wasting her time. You heard me right. Wasting her time with 20 minutes of commercials. She's demanding a full refund, the equivalent to $5 in compensation, 15 cents for emotional damages, and she wants a written apology.
Wow.
Yeah. In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.